today in Studio 360.
There's the camera, and this one says, be a beautiful girl. Do you want to be a beautiful girl?
Yeah, I do. I've always wanted to be a beautiful girl.
Okay.
We burrow deep into contemporary Japan.
I'm excited.
Meeting cutting-edge artists, designers, and architects in helter-skelter Tokyo.
City of changing. Constantly changing, changing, changing.
Plus, I get to geek out totally in a toy store for grown-ups.
Well, if you look over there, you can see all the varieties of wigs.
This is awesome. But you see, seeing these dolls, I would expect to see this place full of girls, but I have yet to see them.
It's all made in Japan. This hour of
Studio 360 with Carl Anderson.
Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
Studio 360 in Japan was originally broadcast in 2009.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is a special edition of Studio 360, Japan. In the 1990s, something strange happened in Japan. The bubble they had going popped. The economy tanked and pretty much stayed that way. Sound familiar? But at the same time, Japanese culture was expanding all over the globe. Pokemon landed. Sushi really swept America. Americans fell in love with Miyazaki movies like Spirited Away. Japan redefined a certain kind of cool all over the world. And still today, if you want cutting-edge design, technology, pop culture, you look to Japan, which was definitely the case in my household.
Studio 360, 私はケイト・アンダーソンです。
That is my daughter, Kate. She's been obsessed with anime and manga since she was 10 years old.
Dad, there's that big camphor tree. It's incredible.
I remember when I was little and I saw My Neighbor Totoro for the first time, which
the
is
Miyazaki
a
Miyazaki film.
Yeah, just being stunned by the like level of detail in the background.
That's Totoro's tree.
Yeah.
Come on, Dad. Can't you go any faster?
He puts so much detail and attention in a tree, or like making sure that a stream has tadpoles in it. I think that's part of why it's so easy to get so into it. It's like the gateway drug to Japan.
Now she's in college, an Asian studies major, spending a semester in Tokyo.
A lot of what I know is because of anime and manga. I know a lot about the school system because of it. I know a lot about food and behavioral things because of it.
You've had 10 years of preparation.
Yeah, you could say that.
Very different from when I was a kid. My own first conscious encounter with anything Japanese was finding these strange old yen notes stuck way back in my dad's dresser drawer. He had fought in the Pacific during World War II, and I'd been fascinated by the very few war stories that he would tell, like when a kamikaze plane slammed into his ship and cut it in half. Nowadays, it's hard to imagine that Japan suffered such a devastating defeat. The country after the war emerged as this global power and cultural force to be reckoned with. And today, living as we do with Japanese technology and culture all around us, what about the Japan we don't really know? Today, we're taking a dive into 21st century Japan to try to see what makes it tick. First stop, Shibuya.
Studio 360 in Shibuya.
Shibuya is a neighborhood in downtown Tokyo that's an epicenter of pop culture. Imagine Blade Runner without the flying cars. It's crowded, pulsating, electric, and seems to practically go on forever. It's also heaven for teenagers. In a place like this, you need a clued-in friend.
My parents gave me a name that Japanese people can't pronounce.
Really?
Because they don't have the L in the Japanese
right.
alphabet.
That is Lisa Katayama. She grew up in Tokyo, but went to college in America and now writes a Japanese pop culture blog called Tokyo Mango.
My password says Risa and in brackets Lisa. Risa Lisa.
I'd love to go on some of the paths you took as an adolescent around here.
Sure, let's do it.
Okay.
So we'll go this way. This is called Prikura no Mecca, sticker picture Mecca. This store is full of giant booths.
Like photo booths.
Yeah, photo booths.
But instead of just being the simple black and white picture of you and your friends that I had when I was a kid, these are incredibly decorative color photos with all kinds of writing on them and flowers and smiley faces.
The software is so advanced now that it'll make you look more beautiful, or you can make your eyes look bigger, or you can change your hair color. But let's go in.
There is one big rule at the sticker picture Mecca.
You can't go in alone.
No boys allowed. Unless...
I can go in because I'm with you.
Yeah. So this one says, be a beautiful girl. Do you want to be a beautiful girl?
I do. I've always wanted to be a beautiful girl.
Okay. We have to put 400 yen in a slot. There's the camera and...
And so do we get to choose anything?
We have to make a lot of choices.
Okay.
Do you want to be a sweet, beautiful girl or a colorful, beautiful girl?
I think just a sweet, beautiful girl.
Okay.
And then, as the phrase goes, it's time for us to vogue.
You have to do that pose.
Oh, we're actually supposed to imitate these poses.
Yeah, oops, we totally screwed up. Okay, hula.
And that's just step one.
Oh, hello.
Now it's time to decorate the photos.
All right, so now you grab a pen.
Okay.
And just go to town on this photo.
So there's little bugs, little mushrooms, little rabbits, all these little...
It's kind of like Photoshop, kind of.
This is cool.
All right, well, okay. I think we're beautiful enough now
I'd say we're pretty beautiful girls.
And presto, a couple of minutes later, out come two sheets of a dozen teeny tiny stickers with our photos on them.
It's a very private thing, taking those sticker pictures. You know, like, if a guy ever asked a girl if he could see her sticker picture collection, she would be really offended.
Really?
It's almost like asking a girl if you could see her underwear.
This is, I really feel like I've seen Japan I barely knew existed, and certainly that I could never have gone to by myself. I feel like I've been taken into some lair or sanctum. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And now we've solidified our friendship and this day on sticker picture.
Friends forever.
Studio 360 in Japan!
After we emerged from the beautiful girl booth, the place had filled up. Everywhere I looked, I saw those iconic, smiling schoolgirls with the short skirts, the knee socks, the black patent leather shoes. They are the very images from my daughter's manga and anime and from Takashi Murakami paintings. That slightly disconcerting, absolutely uniform, super cuteness come to life. What about the girls who grew up in this culture? How are they expressing themselves? My new buddy Lisa Katayama went off to meet some young female art stars who are twisting the old archetypes.
I'm at a tiny bar in Golden Guy, an old nightlife district hidden behind the neon lights of Shinjuku. It's an intimate place. It seems like everybody who walks in is a friend of the bartender. They all call her Toasty. That's because, when she's not here, she puts a toaster on her head and vacuum cleaners on her feet and becomes Toast Girl. Toast Girl looks like she stepped right out of the pages of a comic book. In her music videos, she's a giant standing in space, vacuuming the earth while singing pop songs. She has a cult following all over the world. Even DJs in Berlin have picked up on her music. But Toasty wasn't always an artist. In fact, she was planning to become an accountant.
I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the board.
It wasn't until she studied abroad in Australia that she realized accounting was boring.
You know, it's not the kind of thing that I should study in Australia, you know? I should explore more, but I didn't realize for a long time, maybe 3 years.
So she did a brave thing, unusual for a Japanese woman to do. She quit and pursued art instead.
I did everything that I wanted to do. You know, I was very closed maybe, because study was too hard, you know. So I went crazy maybe.
Toast Girl rejected a conformist life and makes a point of poking fun at domesticity. But if you ask her if she's a feminist, she won't go there.
The characters are like alter egos that live inside of me. I have almost no consciousness of them. If I try to explain it, a lot of words come out, so there must be a reason for them. But I've never really thought about it much myself. Maybe that's the problem.
There's a stereotype that women artists in Asia are oppressed. But Japanese women artists are not oppressed at all.
Yumi Yamaguchi is a contemporary art critic and author of 4 books about artists like Toast Girl. She's one of the few women experts in Japan's male-dominated art world.
They don't have any consciousness of oppression. In fact, women don't even have to think about things that men are tied down by, like carrying a family name or feeding a family. So they feel very free.
Hello, my name is Erina Matsui.
Erina Matsui shows and sells her paintings all over the world.
My birthday is January 80th.
She's only 24, and she's still a student.
My blood type is A. I love shrimp chili. I'm from Okayama. It's a kind of introduction, self-introduction.
She's reading the inline text from her most famous painting, I Love Shrimp Chili. It's a giant self-portrait of Matsui sitting in front of a bowl of shrimp. Her nose is pointed into the steamy air, her chin is slightly crinkled, and a ring hovers over her head.
It looks like a halo.
Yes, like an angel. Now I'm going to heaven with my shrimp chili.
Also, you drew like hanamizu?
In front of a hot Chinese dish, I got a... I got a sniff?
Booger.
Booger. Booger. That sounds good, booger.
Matsui's a cute girl, no doubt about it. But all her paintings have something that play on her self-image, like the booger.
Yes, this is all of my work.
There's a painting also, of Matsui spewing out a wild boar, or as a Siamese twin with two puckered up lips. In another, she wears a giant mushroom on top of her head. I wonder, is she saying that it's okay to be imperfect, to be uncute, and to still be in the public eye?
I don't want to... very heavy meaning in my painting. I really like to make many people laugh by my painting.
But not all the artists I met were thinking happy thoughts.
Someone being killed while everyone's laughing?
That's 29-year-old Mahomi Kunikata, describing the scenes in some of her earlier drawings.
Someone being bullied during a field trip while everyone else is having fun.
Kunikata is painfully shy. She's a bona fide otaku. She grew up reading manga and wanted to become a comic book artist. But then she was discovered by art superstar Takashi Murakami, and he invited her to work in his studio.
This piece is called Stomach Sword Mayu-chan.
She's showing me a picture of a cute blonde-haired girl in knee-high socks and a short dress. There's a huge knife jutting out of her stomach and blood splattered on her clothes and cheeks.
Mayu-chan was kidnapped by a bad guy and brainwashed. Her older brother is strong, so he chases the bad guy away, but when Mayu-chan runs up to him for a comforting hug, a knife comes out of her stomach and stabs him. That's why there's all that blood. It's all her brother's blood.
She shows me another drawing of a schoolgirl, sitting on a floor with her legs spread open. She's not wearing any underwear, and there's a box of crayons spilled out in front of her.
Someone stuffed her genital area with crayons? So I think this is an image of her taking them out one by one.
Who put them in there?
I don't know.
I asked Kunikata why she draws these scenes of cute girls being violated.
There's no particular reason why I draw these. I think it's stuff everyone thinks about.
Rather than see things as a problem, these women tend to laugh them off.
That was art critic Yumi Yamaguchi again. What she's getting at is that in Japan, cuteness is used to take the edge off of more serious matters, which just aren't talked about. So deep-seated thoughts and emotions often surface in unconventional ways. Like with these artists, they all seem to be making pretty bold statements about feminism, but they just won't admit it.
Apparently, there are all these creations in my subconscious. Sometimes it's in a dream, but not always. Sometimes it just plop. Falls out.
For Studio 360, I'm Lisa Katayama.
You can see some work by the artist in Lisa's story and, maybe a little scarier, a video of me posing as a beautiful girl at studio360.org. Coming up, helping me if you can, I feel in time. It can really suck to be a young person in Japan. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
Today's Hour of Studio 360 was originally broadcast in 2009.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is a special edition of
Studio 360 in Japan!
Roland Keltz has written extensively about Japan's influence on American pop culture. He is the author of the book Japan America. His mom is Japanese, and although he grew up mainly in the U.S., as a child, he regularly trekked back and forth to the mother country.
My friends were kind of envious that I had these wild masks and manga from this faraway country that was so much wilder than Spider-Man.
On these trips with his mother, Roland became entranced by the city.
Because Tokyo was so safe, she would just let me run. You know, she would be seeing her former classmates and old buddies, and I would just be running through this amazing city with all this color and light and all these fantastic electronic stores.
Wow.
And I loved all the synthesizers in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd go home with
these synthesizers. At the dawn of the synthesizer.
Exactly, yeah, right. So it was definitely thrilling. And it was kind of like my little secret.
Where are we? Where have you brought me?
We're now in Akihabara, which is more or less the ground zero of Japanese pop culture and electronics. You know, the hippest anime and manga are being sold, in some cases produced. And at the same time, you can find the latest cell phone gadget. So it's ground zero also for otaku culture, the culture of Japanese hyper-obsessive geeks. The actual concept of otaku is from an essay that was written in, I think, the early 1980s.
Is that right?
Yes. And otaku actually roughly translates as hello, sir. And the reason it was used for these geeks is that they rarely made eye contact with each other, but they would see each other in the same stores and locations. So because they were so shy, they wouldn't say each other's names. They would more or less kind of look away but say, hello, sir, acknowledging, you know, the presence of the other, but not really having a conversation.
Should we walk? So, at first glance, what I would call this is a toy store.
Yeah, you'd think, but these are people who take toys very, very seriously.
Well, it's so a toy store with no one under probably 21 in the place.
Right, exactly. Yes, here you can actually see otaku types firsthand.
What? This is cool.
Yeah.
This is like dollhouse furniture
from
every era imaginable, like the 40s, the 50s. See, seeing these dolls, I would expect to see this place full of girls, but I have yet to see them.
Now, this is called Dolphy, which is a mix of doll and figurine.
Oh, that's awesome. So you can buy, like, dozens of different shapes and figures for every piece of the doll that you create yourself.
That's right. An interactive doll fetish.
That's amazing.
Well, if you look over there, you can see all the varieties of wigs.
This is awesome. And here is an entire vitrine devoted to eyeballs. We should get a picture of that.
Of the eyeball case, yes.
So now I see, here's the violin carrying cases. That's interesting. It makes me now, as I've seen girls carrying violin cases on the subway, I thought, oh, there's much, the classical music tradition
you
is so alive and well.
Yes. Silly, Kurt. So let's head out to the street and get some fresh air.
Yes, I badly need some fresh air. So we're now a little bit away from where we were looking at all the figurines and cards and collectibles and electronics before. What happened at this intersection in June?
About 12:30 in the afternoon, this street was filled with pedestrians, and Tomohiro Kato, a 25-year-old laborer, drove his rented truck right through this intersection and ran over three people who died. He jumped out of his truck and started indiscriminately stabbing pedestrians on the side streets. And in all, he killed seven people and stabbed something close to 14 or 15. And it was a shock that it happened right here in the center of the kind of colorful, wacky world of Japanese popular culture.
So as these murders happened, was he apprehended immediately? Did people tackle him? What happened?
No. In fact, one of the shocks was that the police, in fact, he actually killed a policeman. One of the dead was a police officer who approached him and tried to calm him down. You know, this is not a gun culture, so people here were just stunned. But at the time, several pedestrians were standing at this very intersection holding up their cell phones, and some of them were actually streaming the footage onto the internet. So you could actually watch in real time on your computer as these bodies lay bleeding in the street. And this outcry went up in Japan that why did these people who were holding their cell phones not bother to help? And again, that sort of revealed the darker side of this hyper-advanced technological culture and the degree to which a virtual world can explode.
At our website, studio360.org, you can see a video of Roland and me exploring Akihabara. On that afternoon last June, Akihabara certainly lost some of its playful innocence. Now, one of the only visible signs of the nightmare is a small bouquet of flowers hanging from the railing on a corner of the intersection. We sent Roland off on his own to try to suss out the shadowy side of Japanese young people.
You might recognize this music. It's from My Neighbor Totoro, created by Academy Award winner Hayao Miyazaki. In November, Miyazaki called a press conference because he seems to think the children of Japan are in trouble.
When we look at the environment our children are raised in, we see that they get all their pleasure from virtual worlds, including my own animated films. They love television, games, email, mobile phones, and manga comic books. But all of these virtual worlds have one thing in common. They're weakening young Japanese, taking away their inherent natural strength.
Ask anyone in Japan about the younger generation, and you'll hear about three big problems. The first is hikikomori, or extreme social withdrawal, kids and young adults who won't leave their rooms for months or years. This is remarkably common in Japan, and there's no real parallel for it here in America. Then there's kireru, or snapping, in an outburst of violence, just like the stabbing incident in Tokyo. And then there's a stereotype that's unfortunately accurate, suicide. Japan's suicide rate per capita is double America's, and 30-somethings are now the most likely group in Japan to kill themselves.
I actually think that these days, having some kind of problem or disease has become kind of cool.
Misumi Mizuki is a 27-year-old poet. She used to cut her wrists and run wild, shoplifting and even stealing cars.
I wrote about wrist cutting and other problems, and the slogan back then was that it was kind of a jihad, a holy war fought by the younger generation against their elders.
So why do you think young people might feel like it's cool to be hikikomori, socially withdrawn?
Maybe not exactly cool, but for example, my boyfriend now is younger. I noticed he had a cut on his wrist, just a small one, and I asked him if he was okay, and he said, sure, everybody's doing it.
Sure, we've had these problems in America, but for decades, we've also had social service networks and counselors who reach out to teens, or at least they try to. Japan really doesn't, so individuals just accidentally get involved, like this guy.
Sometimes I'm a writer, and sometimes I'm a singing clown, and sometimes I'm a counselor.
For 5 years, Tatsuya Akikawa hosted a radio call-in program. He talked to over 1,300 people on air, mostly teenagers.
A lot of teenagers said to me they couldn't feel real feelings of living.
Mm-hmm. They couldn't feel real feelings of living. He says they live a shadow of a life rather than a life. Eventually, Akikawa retired the show.
What could I do? I started drinking. It wasn't good for my health. Some of my listeners died. People started pointing the finger, saying, who do you think you are?
I'm from American Radio.
Oh.
Can I record you play a little bit?
Okay.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Is it okay?
Yeah. Very, very thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. When I was younger, so much younger than today,
I never need anybody helping anyway. Kohei Suzuki hangs out in Yoyogi Park in Tokyo on the weekends. It's a place where a lot of young people gather to let their hair down, read poetry, sing songs, or just play hacky sack. On weekdays, Kohei is what Japanese call a frita, a freelancer or outsourced worker. And he doesn't like it very much. Won't you please help me? The declining birth rate means that Suzuki's generation is small and shrinking. It doesn't really have much of a voice in Japanese society. A lot of older Japanese, like director Hayao Miyazaki, blame technology. Has Japan been so successful at creating virtual worlds that its young people can't handle the real one?
Since I was young, I've had to a certain extent a rebellious relationship to the system or society of Japan.
Ryu Murakami is the godfather of Japanese punk fiction, but lately he's been writing nonfiction, books that try to give young people guidance.
But if I can use a father and child metaphor, Japan as the father, my father is sick now, bedridden. There's no point being rebellious against a sick father.
Japan still feels like an overprotective parent. Hushed, pre-recorded voices follow you everywhere. Be careful on the platform, they say. Watch your step on the escalator and take good care. Gochuii kudasai. You hear these messages everywhere. It's like a cocoon of comfort. The trains and streets are clean. Crime is low and service is excellent. In fact, expats call Japan the velvet coffin. But it's a lie. The labor market is the worst since World War II. Businesses restructured radically after the 1990s, and the jobs they created are part-time, with low wages, uneven schedules, and scant benefits. Some workers have single-day contracts. They show up at a company to put in just one day's work. The velvet coffin has no lid. Won't you please help me? Help me. Help me. I met a young software programmer named Tatsuya Yashiro.
Well, I was having job interviews at companies when I was graduating university.
Tatsuya Yashiro interviewed at 50 different companies.
But no company was going to hire me.
Yashiro was nearly hikikomori, or a shut-in. He spent all his time on the internet and looking at dirty manga.
I'm still a virgin, but I do think that real girls are swell.
But Tatsuya had a little intervention from a mentor, and he started offering his HTML coding skills as an independent business. He's 27 now, and he is something new in Japan, a young entrepreneur with two employees headquartered in prime Tokyo real estate. Being the boss is a serious challenge for a guy like him.
Trying to communicate what I want to them in the first place is very hard. And trying to make a place where they feel comfortable is very hard. Talking about salaries. But I have these people in my life every day, and that's great.
Maybe Japan is finally learning to make room in the margins for a man like Tatsuya. And for Mizuki Misumi, the poet we heard before who used to cut herself. She managed to get her poems published in a collection called Overkill, and it won two of the country's most prestigious poetry awards.
Hikikomori can be seen as a kind of rebellion, a call for attention. Or maybe they just can't figure out what they want to do with their lives.
She read me a poem called Amanogawa, or the Milky Way. It's spoken or sung in the voice of a daughter crying out for her mother. She tries to explain her need for pills, to self-medicate in a world she can't navigate on her own. One of its lines is, "Your daughter hides blood in the ink."
On the afternoon that it was shown that the world was not enough for me, the pill was my friend. Mother, how can you say that it is poison?
Japanese youth are troubled, but they are less materialistic than their elders, less obsessed with the corporate ladder, more entrepreneurial, and, it seems to me, more creative. Just check out the kids performing in Yoyogi Park every weekend, letting it all hang out. And if Japan's establishment can reward a poet like Mizuki for singing her generation's pain, there may be reasons to be optimistic about Japan's next generation. For Studio 360, this is Roland Keltz.
それが毒だと手足ができるより先に知ってはいたのだ。
よかった。ありがとうございました。
What turned out to be one of my favorite spots in Tokyo gave us a break from the mad pace of the city just when we needed it. It's called The Lion. Music fills the room, classical music. It's a dark, wood-paneled cafe, but it looks almost like a chapel, a chapel where people are smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. Rows of wooden benches all face toward these 12-foot wooden speakers, almost like an altar. And the music is played on old LPs. You can hear the hiss and scratches, but the sound is still incredible. There's one man sitting alone in the back with a pen in hand going over a manuscript. There's another guy reading by himself. There's one sleeping in his seat. Nobody speaks. Everyone is perfectly quiet, just listening. It's amazing. It's like stepping through some kind of time warp or into a piece of fiction, a story set in some quasi-European place between the world wars. And
And I realized that these old-school classical music freaks in the Lion were just as obsessed with their fantasy as any other otaku. So what is the real Tokyo?
City of changing. Constantly changing, changing, changing.
Coming up, we'll leave all the otaku dreamscapes behind, and I'll go wandering with an architect who takes me off the grid.
Now we're walking through an empty little lot.
It's a new path.
This feels very illegal, Yoshi.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC.
What did that mean?
We'll be right back, so just stay where you are.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and today in Studio 360, we're checking out what's happening, really happening, in Japan today. Most of us have an idea of Japanese-ness in design. Simplicity, subtlety, meticulous craftsmanship, like paper walls and tatami mats and black lacquered bowls. But maybe that's just our cliched Western idea.
What would you say is distinctively Japanese in Japanese design?
I wish you would tell me.
That is Tokujin Yoshioka. He is a big-time designer of dreamy interiors and objects like solid glass chairs that look like they're made of ice.
If I explain with cooking, I can use tofu as an example. When you first see it, it's just a simple square white thing. You don't even know if it's cuisine or not. But within that simple square, there's already been a lot of preparation done. The outcome is a quite simple form, but once you taste it, these other processes in its production reveal themselves.
So, Japanese things look simple and beautifully composed because there is so much careful planning involved. But tell that to anybody trying to navigate Tokyo, and not just tourists. Even locals can't make sense of the jumble of streets here. It seems so inefficient, so unharmonious. Not at all what I think of as Japanese.
The very important characteristic of Tokyo is city of changing. So we are constantly changing, changing, changing.
Yoshiharu Tsukamoto is a partner in the up-and-coming architecture firm Atelier Bow Wow. He designs ingenious buildings in the nooks and crannies of jam-packed Tokyo, such as his own house, a very contemporary living and working space of wood and glass. Each floor is just one room, but they're open one to the next and staggered to maximize the building's tiny footprint. His deck overlooks the old neighborhood.
You see different era, different time, different social condition, different notion of the family, different economical situation in different era. And because in this 85 years, Japanese society changed a lot, and construction techniques changed a lot, material changed a lot. So those three generations built almost like a different city. But it is overlaid in one place.
He took me out for a walk to see how that overlaying works.
Okay, let's go this way. I think it's more interesting.
His street is only 12 feet wide.
If you see those buildings, one and that building, they were built, I guess, in 50s.
Right.
So I think they are second generation of house. Oh, that is first generation?
Oh, this little one-story wooden house?
Little one-story house.
With a tile, traditional tile roof.
Yeah.
Now, when would that have been built?
I think it's before war.
I would think, yeah.
Yeah, it's built in 30s and 40s. Because this area didn't have damage by war.
Oh, this is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Wow. So we're overlooking 20 feet below us, 30 feet below us, a cemetery.
Yeah.
Which in its form looks like a modern city. There are lots of little skyscrapers, right? It looks like a model of a city. completely.
My grandparents was living in traditional Japanese house. My parents' house was a mixture between Western and Japanese. And for our generation, traditional Japanese tatami space became more like a symbol. It's not very the efficient space anymore.
Shigeru Ban is one of Japan's star architects.
Within three generations, lifestyle is totally changing. So that the lifestyle of Japanese people is very flexible.
That means designers can be flexible too. Shigeru's most famous buildings are made partly out of big, stiff paper tubes. And he says there's another thing that lets Japanese architects innovate so freely.
In Japan, we have a much smaller liability problem here. So we can be very experimental.
Because it's not so litigious, you can experiment more as an architect.
Yeah, we don't sue each other. So that people accept the more experimental, innovative thing here.
Without worrying about an unhappy client coming after you in the courts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I went to visit a woman named Reiko Sudo, who founded a textile company called Nuno. She turns improbable materials like metals and plastics into these amazing, luxurious fabrics.
Lately, I've been working with silk mill.
Uh-huh.
And I will show you some of the raw material of silk.
Okay.
And which is the shell of the cocoon.
Really?
Yeah. This is kibiso, we call it.
Reiko has an advantage working in a country that's very high tech, but which still nurtures craftsmanship and small-scale manufacturing.
So how do you feel?
Wow. It's almost like a plant material. It's like something you'd make a broom of or something, you know? And it feels like a plant.
Yeah. Yes, yes. This is like actually skin of the...
This is the waste skin material?
Yeah. Waste material. And normally silk industry didn't use this one.
It's very stiff, right?
Yes, very, very stiff. And I thought maybe we could work with more casual look or...
Right.
Look at this hat.
This hat. Wow, that's great. But you would never think of this as silk. This is a funky hat.
That's right.
And so when you went, you were walking around your silk factory and you saw this stuff in the corner and you said, oh, I want that. Did they think you were crazy?
Well, they said, are you serious?
Yeah.
Are you going to use this one? And I said, yes, why not? I just wanted to try.
Well, show me some other materials. This is fantastic.
Another of her fabrics looks and feels like silk, but when you ball it up in your fist, it holds the shape almost exactly, like some kind of fabric from the future.
Huh.
And this is telephone wire out of copper.
Yes. Little tiny, fine copper wire.
Yes, it's a telephone wire.
And this very soft, subtle sort of coppery pink color is the color of the wire.
The color of the wire.
That's fantastic.
Isn't it nice color?
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of pink, but this is fantastic.
But you have to be careful to go through the custom.
Oh, yeah. The airline security would not like this, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
When Reiko founded her company, Nuno, 25 years ago, a woman running her own business was almost unheard of. And it's still rare.
I think I actually felt some insecure feeling at the time.
Uh-huh.
Because, when I started, I only hired women.
Why do you think that was? Because you wanted to give women an opportunity or because you'd rather just keep boys out of it?
Just keep. And I don't want to. I think in Japanese sense, if I'm hiring boy, then I have to look after this boy forever. But for women, I can maybe like,
that's interesting.
Old star Japanese behavior.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
No, it's interesting. You can take the girl out of feudal Japan, but you can't take the feudal Japan out of the girl, I guess.
Yeah, yes. Some of my staff were saying, like, you are so tough to me, like the girl, like a lady. But for the boys, I'm so nice. I'm too nice.
Yeah. You have a child as well.
Yes, boy.
Yeah.
Boy.
There you go. Do you find any difficulty balancing the entrepreneurial designer life with being a mother?
Very difficult.
Yeah.
I have some kind of like images. as a mother, like as a head of company. Lately, lots of dinner always my husband made, and I still feel so guilty. Oh no, I had to make dinner for my family. But look at my boy, he doesn't care. Oh, I'm lucky because she's not home and I can do anything I want, but I feel so, oh no, 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 I had to do it.
Because you're not living up to the image of the perfect mother?
Yes. Yeah. Japanese woman has to do everything.
Yeah. So even when Japan looks so cutting edge in so many ways, the past still has this very strong hold. Talk to a modern artist, a modern with a capital M artist, and you get the sense of how often what they do is rooted in traditional practice, like meditation.
I sit in front of my computer and try to empty myself and wait.
Shuntaro Tanakawa is Japan's most famous living poet.
And then some word emerging from beneath of my foot. Like a plant, I put my foot as a root to Japanese language soil, so I can suck the kind of juice, nutrients from Japanese language. And I try to make a flower.
In his poem, A Night Radio, Tanakawa writes about his childhood passion for tinkering with old radios.
夜のラジオ。ハンダゴテを手に僕は1949年製のフィルコのラジオをいじっている。
A night radio. I'm holding a soldering iron, tinkering with a 49 Philco. Despite warm tubes, the radio is stubbornly silent, but its odor, still fresh, mesmerizes me. Why do ears wish to hear beyond their capacity? I think we hear much too much nowadays, and I feel nostalgic over this broken radio's silence. I can't say which is the more important to me, tinkering with a radio or writing a poem. I long for the days when I had nothing to do with poems and walked those dusty childhood roads. But I've forgotten about women and friends as though time did not exist. I just wanted to hear, should have heard, something more. My breath held, my ear cocked, in every summer's towering clouds. In the muttering of family get-togethers in an untidy room, refusing to compress living into a story.
生きることを物語に要約してしまうことに逆らって。
Shuntaro Tanakawa, along with his translator William Elliot. After rushing around Tokyo for days and days, I left in search of Tanakawa's dusty roads and stubborn silence. 3 trains, a ferry boat, and 5 hours later, I arrive in Naoshima, a tiny island in Japan's inland sea. A billionaire businessman turned this little fishing island into a contemporary art complex. Its jewel is a small museum that contains just a few pieces by 3 artists, including one artist whose medium is light. I sit on a stone bench in an empty 25-foot-high room, and for a long time, I don't know really how long, stare up at a frame piece of sky. Clouds float past. The light shifts slightly. One moment, the blue rectangle looks perfectly flat, and the next, it stretches out to infinity. This experience, totally futuristic and totally timeless, on a barren little island in the middle of nowhere, seemed to me perfectly Japanese. But this work of art, it was created by the artist James Turrell, an American, kind of a cowboy, actually, from Arizona. Even as Japan has become outwardly more like the West, it seems as if globalization works both ways. The rest of the world is becoming a bit more Japanese.
And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. We've got all kinds of photos and videos from our trip to Japan at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can subscribe to our free weekly podcasts of the show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisvaram,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Jamie York,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Special thanks to Junko Takeuchi, the voice of the anime character Naruto. Thanks also to Ken Marks, Chris Bannon, Amy Bussum, Alex Villari, Anna Boyko-Ryrock, Ralph Samuelson, Yoko Shioya, David James, Matthew Kavner, and Katsuo Kawamura. And an especially deep bow of gratitude to David DeHealy and Shizu Yuasa.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Artworks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the novel that brought white America face to face with racism.
Richard Wright was saying, let's stop asking for permission. Let's stop selling ourselves. Let's stop apologizing. If you're angry and you know it, clap your hands. You know?
I'm Kurt Anderson, Richard Wright's native son. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Stay happy.